This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Summer vacation. Need I say more? From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is about journeys, discoveries, and new places. It's time to get out and discover the world. Installment number one is from my conversation with two experts on the subject of travel. Travel agents Renee Jensen and Mary Hoffman. They work at Neely's Travel, the only independent travel agency left in Moscow, Idaho, after the internet seemed to wipe so many of them off the map. Neely's Travel serves this small university town with travel planning for business and pleasure. They talked to me in their office in downtown Moscow on July 20th, 2010. Renee Jensen has been a travel expert since 1996. We hear from her first. So I'm here at Neely's Travel, and I am talking to Renee and Mary, who are travel agents, and they're our experts for the week. And I appreciate you spending some time in your busy day while we're here at the office to do this. I wanted to start by asking you about changes in the travel agency business, especially with the advent of the internet. I'm sure everything has changed. I know from my point of view, it has.
Huh? I kind of knew that question was coming.
Of course.
Well, I've worked in the industry since, and with this office since 96. So it's been a while. But honestly, the difference between travel agency versus the internet, especially with having a university town, we do a lot of corporate travel here. A lot of it, though, is really realizing that the taxpayers pay for the university, and it's keeping your dollar locally in the community. We get the same prices as they do online. It really changed when 9/11 hit because everybody wanted customer service and wanted a lot more personal attention. Somebody to talk to about their reservations when they were stranded, or so the business has really come back to the community, and with it being locally supported and funded, we have a lot of clients that are realizing that, keeping the dollar locally in the community and helping us out too.
Would you say your work on a regular, weekly, monthly basis, whatever, is more the group thing or more the individual?
No, it's more an individualized trips custom to the individual. It's not a group travel.
It sounds like it's mostly business.
Mary does a lot more. She does a lot more leisure.
I'm the cruise, I'm the Europe, I'm, you know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you told me, Renee, a little bit about how long you've been doing it. Mary, what's your story?
I started before the beginning of time. I became a travel agent in 1974.
Oh, wow.
Right out of college.
What was that like?
There were no computers.
Yeah.
Computers did not exist except for maybe a few at the airlines. We had tariff books that looked like, if you've ever been to a Napa auto parts store, those giant books, and we'd flip them from side to side and put together point to point to point, and that's what you paid.
Wow.
That's from the airline.
And those airfares did not change until you got new pages in your book.
Oh, and airlines were regulated, making a big difference.
Right.
Totally. Yeah. We were the outlet for airlines. They paid us to be their people across the world that sold them. And then slowly automation started, and I call them the dumb blue box because it was all airline feed. We saw what the airline saw at the counter. There was no going beyond that. You know, so, and then automation, slowly the ticket printers came in, because we used to handwrite everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've kind of been here since the beginning of time.
Can you point to, maybe you just did point to, the biggest change?
There's been huge changes. The all the big mega carriers, that the Pan Ams, the Eastern Airlines, you know, TWA, all the big international carriers, where it was you dressed up in suits and dresses to get on a plane. It was very formal. You were very privileged at that time to fly away. And in when actually the biggest change came with the bicentennial, they came out with reduced fares so that the general public could go back east, see the historical sites and everything. And I think that was the beginning of fare wars. And then the whole industry just started speeding up and changing after that.
Well, that's great.
That's great. Isn't that interesting?
And see, and I think the for not doing it as long, the biggest change that I've seen is from when the airlines paid us, they paid us a 10% commission on the ticket sale. Then they dropped it to 8. Then they went to 5. Now they don't pay us anything. That's where the booking fees come in. And that's why, like, the internet charges a booking fee or a travel agent charges a booking fee. A lot of the time the internet hides it. They put it in their ticket cost and you don't know it. We're upfront about it, what you're going to pay. But a lot of the time, even with our booking fees, we have beaten the internet. We have come in lower than the internet. And on internationals, we have, you know, wholesale companies.
Yeah,
so
many places to go.
So we have a lot more opportunities with the internet too, and a lot more advantages.
You said you started right out of college.
Mm-hmm.
Why? How did that happen? Did you fall into it?
I did. Yeah. I totally fell into it. I had a very, very good friend, and I was going door to door for the Heart Fund on summer break. And she says, "Would you like to be a travel agent?" And it was the correct place and time. I said, "Sure." You know, and then
the rest is history.
Yeah, pretty much. She was a lovely lady.
How would you say having made that choice or fallen into it has impacted your life?
It has given me the opportunity to travel.
What does that mean?
What does that mean to me? Because I have been able to see the world change. Going places that are totally different now than they were when I was able to get out there and really do a lot of trips. Seeing Hawaii when it was not as commercial. The lady I worked for was one of the first tours into China when they opened up. So a lot of history has gone on, you know, world history, basically. But it is, it's exciting. She has the opportunity of showing her daughter places. So it opens up a big world, seeing our differences, seeing our likes and similarities. It really is a wonderful thing to do.
Can you point to any one or two things that are the biggest, have impacted you the most about those similarities and differences?
That, well, okay, the world is not totally glamorous. That's what you see on TV. I mean, those people have jobs. They work in construction. Some of them don't drive cars or are unable to afford cars or homes, are apartment dwellers, you know, but they are living their life in different countries, and we get to observe that, basically, and sometimes fraternize with them. The first time I went to France, I went with a girlfriend whose aunts and uncles were over there. So we saw the blue collar, the white collar, and then we saw the elite. They lived in a gated community. So I kind of got the advantage of seeing their lifestyles and how similar, but yet how different they are, you know, to mine. And that's what travel should be all about. Yeah. To me. Anyway.
So, same question for you about impact. Well, but first let me ask you how you got into travel agent.
I actually went to school for it.
Oh, so you knew from the get-go.
Yeah, there's a school over in Vancouver, Washington called the International Air Academy, and I went to school. I absolutely loved it. Coming right out of high school, it's a vocational school for like a 6-month program, but they treat it like a job. You have to dress up. You have to wear skirts can't be, you know, 2 inches above your knees. You can't have sleeveless shirts on and all of it. And you cannot miss one day or you're out. It was a very intense program, but I loved it. And then while I was at school, Mr. Neely actually called and hired me over the phone. He actually, well, I guess not hired, job interviewed me. And when I came back, basically I had a job interview when I was done with school and pretty much was hired.
Back, so you're from Moscow?
I am. I was born and raised.
Yeah, so you knew you were coming back.
Yeah. All my family lives around here, so it was not something that I'm willing to give up.
And
move
Mary,
away.
And Mary says that you have a daughter.
I do. I have a 9-year-old daughter. And she travels the world with me. She's seen so many places at 9 years old that we actually, just this last June, we took 2.5 weeks off and we went to Copenhagen, Russia, Poland, Germany, and Sweden, Finland, Estonia, and London. So she has seen cultures in very different ways.
I know I have a friend who when we were from girlhood, who when we were around 11 or 12, she took a bike trip to Europe. She said it changed her life.
Mm-hmm.
Really changed her perspective in life.
My daughter's perspective was when we were in a pub in Copenhagen and we ordered a hamburger. And over there, they don't eat them with their hands. They eat them with a fork, and they dip it in the condiments. And so it was huge for her to have to cut a hamburger and eat it, you know, a 9-year-old wanting to just pick it up. So she learned a lot of different things, a lot of different aspects of food.
Yeah, food.
Well, it should be a common denominator, but it is very different wherever you go. It may look alike, but it's different.
Renee Jensen and Mary Hoffman are experts in travel. They work together at Neely's Travel in Moscow, Idaho. We're going to hear more travel tips and travel stories from Renee and Mary later in the show.
Travel so far, well, let me get myself back.
People travel for different reasons. I work with a woman who plans her travel so that she can see animals. Perhaps the buffalo with their babies in the spring at Yellowstone, or the eagles gathering in southern Alaska. Perhaps even the swallows coming back to San Juan Capistrano. I have a friend who goes to see the homeless when she visits a city. She's a social worker who lives in a small town with few homeless people. Novella Carpenter visits urban farms. She's an urban farmer herself, the author of Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. Her book tour in fall 2009 took her to cities around the U.S. and the world, where she inevitably says, "Take me to your urban farmers." Installment number 2, Novella Carpenter, "Take me to your urban farmers."
So I've been on book tour, and so every time I go to a new city, I'm like, hey, take me to your urban farmers. And so I go there. This is City Farm in Chicago, and it was kind of the end of the season, and it started to get really cold there. But these are their tomatoes. These are like 6 feet tall tomatoes. It's an acre lot, and they're growing tons and tons of vegetables. I was totally amazed. Like, they're carrots. They grow a lot of stuff in poly houses, you know, like poly tunnels for their salad greens and that kind of thing. But basically the city was just like, look, we have these abandoned lots. do it. And so they come in with these giant bulldozers filled with soil and mulch. They mulch the whole thing, and then they put down French intensive or biointensive beds, and they just grow tons and tons of vegetables. When I was in New York, I went to, because you know, New York, what the hell, there's no extra land. I went to their rooftop, they have a rooftop garden in Brooklyn in Greenpoint, and it is amazing. It's 6,000 square feet of pure vegetables. And what they did is in New York, you know, it's perfect because you get full, you know, sun, you're out of the crap. You don't get the car exhaust and all that stuff. And the buildings are built, especially in this area of Brooklyn, they're built bomb-proof, like huge steel beams across all the roofs to hold them. And so they did the calculations like, oh my God, this roof can support this huge garden. And so they just craned in compost and did French intensive beds and were growing amazing amounts of vegetables and then selling them to restaurants, and they had a CSA. And I mean, in some ways, that's the beauty of city farming. You know, the people are there. You can feed them right there. You don't have to get in a truck. It's like they come and pick stuff and they take it away. There is a big rooftop gardening scene in Chicago as well for similar reasons, but it's huge. It's a really beautiful thing.
From Chicago and New York to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Novella finds a urban farming genius.
Will Allen's project, Growing Power, he just won the MacArthur Genius Grant last year. He's like basically the most famous urban farmer on the planet. Because it's really cold in Milwaukee, he does a series of greenhouses. Those boxes that look like caskets or something, those are actually filled with worms. So he is growing soil. That's his biggest goal, is to grow soil. Every single inch of the place is covered with these like hanging baskets of greens, and they're like mescaline mix, and restaurants pay a lot of money for these. It's like $15 a pound or something. That's kind of his business model. They also grow stuff in polytubes, and one of the things that's interesting is it is freezing cold in Milwaukee right now, but that greenhouse was so warm because of the fabric, but also because that's all compost, hot compost, so it actually heats the greenhouse, so they don't have to have a heater in there, which is really, really smart. They also have goats, which are dear to my heart, and they have beehives. The other thing they do is fish farming. They do aquaculture. So one of the things that is part of their program is that they raise tilapia and yellow perch in these greenhouses, and it's part of an integrated system. So they have the worms are on the bottom, and then there's a layer of greens being grown. And then on each end of the aisle, there's the big tilapia pond. Then that water is actually circulated throughout the vegetables. And so you have this like fertigation thing happening where the poop from the fish is going into the greens. And it was a really beautiful system. They also had turkeys and chickens and ducks, Muscovy ducks. So it's like probably the most complete urban farm in the country that I've seen so far. So I was really impressed with that. And it was just cool to see it. It was like they were employing a lot of people that were like low income who didn't have jobs, and now they have this job, which is being an urban farmer.
Novella doesn't stick to just U.S. cities in her urban farm tours, however.
Urban farming is way bigger in other countries. America is really, really lagging behind. I mean, it's great when Michelle Obama is planting the White House garden or the White House lawn with vegetables, but it's like, you know, we're so far behind. If you go to other countries, especially developing countries, they are farming the hell out of the cities, and it's amazing. So this is one example, downtown Caracas, and they have all these, just a huge market garden where they're harvesting continuously, and they do really innovative stuff. They grow stuff in these giant bags, and they do a lot of really interesting work with worms, so they're also doing the vermicomposting.
Travel opens up new horizons, journeys to new places, and journeys in time. Both reveal new perspectives.
We can take a journey to a different country, or we can take a journey into history. And if you go back, you start to see that this is like the kind of stuff that people were doing before during times of crisis. One of the biggest beginnings of Victory Gardening happened in actually 1893. You know, there was a depression in 1893. And the mayor of Detroit had gone to England, and he had seen these allotment gardens. And they are super productive. And so he got really inspired, and he was like, hey, people should start growing stuff in these vacant lots. So they put people to work, and they grew tons of food. And then that later inspired the whole Victory Garden thing, which was like, Uncle Sam says it's patriotic to grow your own food. And I just, like, I think about that. I think about, you know, all the ways that we can inspire people to start being patriotic by helping yourself and learning something and growing your own food. And I mean, after all, this is what America is founded on, right? Our agricultural roots are the thing that we should be the most proud of. And so to kind of return to that has been, you know, just returning full circle. And I think it's really powerful if you can grow your own food. And it doesn't have to be a farm. It can just be your deck or your patio, and can actually grow quite a bit of stuff. And so I'm really inspired by these historical things, and then also the models that we see in different countries and what's happening in the state.
Novella Carpenter is an urban farmer. She runs Ghost Town Farm in Oakland, California, when she's not on tour promoting her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. It's published by Penguin Press. On installment number 3, I'm joined in the studio by Christina Mangiapane. She has an essay to share with us. It's a reflection of recent events and opinions and about her recent adventures. And what happens when people ask her, are you going alone?
Everyone tries to make it seem so scary, don't they? Maybe they're not even trying. Maybe it's so ingrained they don't have to. Who knows? But there is something. Some insidious, fear-inducing poppycock that has been infecting our minds by way of our culture for at least as long as I've been alive. Which is admittedly not terribly long, but I'm confident it's been occurring well before then, too. What is it? What is that thing that entreats us to balk at the very thought of venturing out on our own, to be adventurous, take risks, face and rise to challenges? Whatever it is, it's adept at draping itself in many guises, and I know you've seen them parading around. Sometimes it masquerades as caring concern. You're not going by yourself, are you? That's dangerous. Probably a bad idea. It is rather sweet to be told you're too vulnerable and weak to take care of yourself, isn't it? So sweet, in fact, it makes my whole effin' headache. At other times, it comes barreling around the corner, out of nowhere, snide and terse. You're gonna get yourself killed, or hurt, or worse. I'm not quite sure what could be worse. Perhaps sticking around here, enduring your ignorant and clumsy perception of my confidence and foresight. For your cussing information, I do have the ability to take the necessary precautions in order to protect myself from suffering the sad and sorry fate of, oh, let's say, a watery grave, or guttery coffin, or cave-like tomb. Give me some credit, will ya? Still, other times, it peeks its little head out, seemingly unknowingly, as an innocent inquiry. Oh, who you going with? Me, myself, and I, biatches. But these are only a handful of the myriad responses and ways by which we're meant to ascertain, from our very own culture, that we are ill-equipped, ill-tempered, ill-mannered, and some other ill word I don't even know, to reign over our lives, let alone navigate the world on our own terms, without assistance. Of course, then, a question arises. Why, in our ever-changing society, in which women now kick ass and take names in a variety of arenas, does this fear-invoking tradition still occur? I have no doubt the answer to that question is multifaceted, complex, and altogether unavailable to entertain our fancy at the moment. I'm not much into fancies anyway, so that's just fine for now. But maybe a more productive question to take on at this particular juncture would be, how do we, as women living individual lives, counteract the impetus to cower in the corner, an impulse which is largely imposed upon us and perpetuated by our culture? A culture, keep in mind, of which we are an integral part. Well, first off, don't. Don't let responses resembling the aforementioned impede your actions. In other words, don't play a part in our culture's perpetuation of such fear. Recognize the pattern that's being woven and unthread it, baby. Take the risks you want to take. face and rise to the challenges. And for Christ's sake, go on some badass adventures. Do it your way. Don't ask permission or apologize. We are the ones who are in charge. We're the ones who have to make our own personal decisions to chafe against the complacent and comfortable norm. We have to do it within the context of our own individual lives. That personal charge can act as the spark to ignite a wildfire of change. And even if it's not a wildfire for a while, a bonfire's good too. Just make sure you keep the fires metaphorical, unless your name's Jessica Hawkinson and you know how to extinguish those bad boys yourself. In doing so, the hope is that soon enough, and little by little, the fear will fade and our interactions and attitudes will more closely align with the following anecdote. After a long week of being told I shouldn't do the things I went out and did anyhow, I attended a barbecue at a friend's house to relax, recover, and reconnect. As I was making small talk, I casually explained my non-plan for the weekend to a friend of mine after he inquired about it. But my story elicited a response different from all the others I had recently and so commonly heard. I explained, "Yeah, so I was planning on going camping this weekend, but one friend forgot about a prior engagement and another just got too busy to go, so I don't know if I'll end up going this weekend. Maybe I'll go next weekend." To which my friend replied, perfect and poignant, "Oh, what? You can't go by yourself?"
I'd like to sail the oceans before the seas run dry. I wanna go by myself. I just room enough for one. Me, myself, and you.
Thanks for coming into the studio today, Christina.
Thanks for having me. Very fun.
You're listening to Yin Radio. Today's show is Journeys and Discoveries. Now, here's a brief insight from Jane Goodall about a different kind of journey, a spiritual journey. From her 2007 visit to Pullman, Washington, here's Jane Goodall.
Dr. Goodall, I'm with Yin Radio, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. I wanted to talk about the spiritual side, which you may have just touched on when you talk about inspiring. Your PBS special with the same title as your talk tonight, mm-hmm. is subtitled A Spiritual Journey. What's spiritual about it? Is it connections with animals, environment, people?
I was brought up in a Christian family. We weren't religious, particularly. My grandfather was actually a minister, but I never met him. He died before I was born. And, so we went to church sometimes, and God was kind of something that we talked about. I had an amazing mother who used to say, you know, if you'd been born in Egypt, you would talk about Allah. And if you'd been born in China, you'd talk about Tao or something. So she believed there was one God. And then when I was in the forest at Gombe, I was there for a long time alone. And so I had this real feeling that there was a great spiritual power. And, you know, I have no other word but God to call it. Whatever it is, it seems to be something stronger than me. And it's been very interesting over the years that people, every time we find the chimps doing something which we used to think only we could do, a lot of intellectual things, using and making tools, all these things, always there's then a new definition. Well, at least this is unique to humans. And they've now come around to the soul. Well, only humans have souls. Well, for one thing, we can't prove that we have souls. I mean, I don't think anybody can. We can't prove it scientifically. And the sort of feeling I got when I was out in the forest is that there's a little spark of this great spirit power in each living thing. And because we humans love to analyze and label things, we've decided that that is a soul. And if it's a soul in us, then I think the chimpanzees also have souls, and dogs, you know. I mean, that's just me. This is nothing scientific. It's just you ask me what, that's how I feel.
Thank you.
sad thing, and the world feels so small again. Some part of me's overseas and waits till I'm back again. I'll meet you out on the train, in a heartbeat, do it all again. And nothing's out.
Coming Back by Tom and Liza, also known as the Wind Whistles, out of Vancouver, Canada. At the top of this Yin Radio show, I was visiting with travel agents Renee Jensen and Mary Hoffman. Let's return to that interview, starting with Renee's schooling, where she studied to be a travel agent.
So when you went to the school, had you already traveled and known that this is what you wanted to do, or was this more of a whim? Did you think you wanted to do this?
I had a couple goals in life and when I graduated high school, and one of them was to become a travel agent. And I had done some travel with my family. We had gone to Disneyland when we were really little, and it was like Mary said, you had to dress up to get on the plane, and they put little white cloths on your table tray, and now it's not that way. I mean, it's more a cattle car when you fly on an airline. It's an air bus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, yes, traveling by air gets you there the quickest and the fastest, in most cases. So,
is there a new high-end way to travel?
Okay,
now that airlines are not the dress-up, fancy, take care of you well.
If you have a private jet.
Assuming you have money. We're not going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There are actually, like, chartered private jets that You know, people have to understand that a charter is you buy the whole plane. You know, so it's not an inexpensive way to travel. But yes, there is that first class experience. Or I think cruising is first class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You get the ambiance of being high end. Yeah.
Do you think that when air travel first started, you know, especially in the, maybe not first started, but let's say in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
It seemed more high-end, it was more dress-up because it still was only more accessible to people with
It was money. Expensive, yes. But the whole, I don't know what you call it, not social demographics, but that's what people did. On Sundays, you dressed up. If you went to Spokane, you dressed up. You know, you were, that's what you did. So why wouldn't you put on your best suit and heels or whatever to board an airplane? You were going somewhere. And they treated you that way. It was a nice thing to do. And now
so
it's get them on and get them off.
Cultural broadly as well as some changes in the
And different countries have a way different mentality of how appearance really is. I mean, when we were in Europe, I mean, the people at McDonald's working had suits and ties on, and they were very clean restaurants.
We're the ones
and
that are the most casual.
Yeah,
in the world.
We have really relaxed.
Yeah, I think our suit and tie sales are really big over here.
Unless you're in cities. Now, big cities, you'll see a whole different look on people. Even
more
in
cosmopolitan anywhere, whether it's,
yeah,
that makes sense too.
Yeah.
And I didn't ask you, how would you say your life, how has having this job and traveling impacted your life?
Oh, it's impacted it tremendously. I mean, just taking my daughter and going somewhere and being able to go to the Caribbean or to Canada or Mexico or the South Pacific or Europe or wherever, it's been an eye-opening experience and one that I would never change.
Tell me a little bit about a different subject, advice for travelers.
Be patient. Come prepared.
And what is prepared?
Prepared is, if you're carrying on your bag, it can only be 47 inches width, height, depth. In that bag, anything that's liquid has to be in one quart size bag, under 3 ounces, and it has to be presented. It has to be taken out of your bag, put on top. That way they know nothing's going on. If you can wear slip-on shoes or flip-flops, because you'll spend your time being barefoot, you know, tie on shoes. I know some people don't wear anything else, but it sure is more convenient to just kick them off and put them in the bin.
I was going to say flip-flops, that kind of enforces that casualness.
Right. You know, the Europeans all wear clogs or backless shoes, you know, so they're in and out of their shoes all the time. But get there early, just be patient. You know, because it's an ordeal to get through the preliminaries before you even get on the airline. You know, and you're not going to receive all the food, and you're not going to receive, you know, all the bennies. They're not there anymore. If you get on the airplane, you have your credit card ready if you want a sandwich, if they're selling food, you know, that type of thing.
So those kind of address some convenience issues. Mm-hmm. What about safety issues? What do you suggest? Let's say it might depend on where they're going.
Well, I sure traveler. Wouldn't be wearing a flag on my chest or saying that I'm.
Unfortunately, yeah. try to be as blend in as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, not everybody's your friend. The people that you meet at the airports are there to sell you something usually, even though they're the same age as you are or whatever. They have an agenda, Not everybody hangs out at the airports or on beaches someplace. Just because you meet somebody that says they're from Miami or from another university, be cautious. You know, don't go with just willy-nilly with someone says, hey, I've got a party to go to. You know, you want to know who, what, where, when, and why.
Well, and be respectful of the country you're entering. Some, like, if you're going to Africa, women are really disgraced upon if they're wearing shorts. And so a dress is better. Or, you know, just know the culture that you're going into and going into it with respect.
So it's kind of like street savvy. And street savvy that might be particular to the
country. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're not going to go in and say,
I'm an American, I can do whatever I
want. Right.
Yeah. They don't like that.
No. Or speak louder in English when they don't understand you.
Exactly.
It doesn't help at all. English louder is not any better than English in a normal spoken voice.
And a smile. You know, if you're trying a few words here and there, the best you can, a smile, people usually say, oh, come on, this way, you know, and they'll be very, very nice. But, yeah, when you go in with an attitude just like everywhere else in the world, you're not going to get the doors open to you that you know, good knowledge of where you're going and a good smile will get you.
What is the best part of your job? The job part. And what's the worst part of your job?
Oh,
I know, that's
the best part. Well, the best part of my job is being able to make people's dreams come true with a vacation. The worst part is if you're messing with somebody's vacation. If something happens on their vacation, yeah, they call you. So, you know, that's the bad part is you don't want any bad part to happen. You want them to have the greatest experiences that they can get, but there are sometimes an unfortunate event that takes place. You know, you can't predict the weather.
Oil spills.
Right. Oil spills or what, you know. Right. You know, so, yeah. It's being able, especially to see somebody say, I've never taken a vacation before in my life, and being able to make that dream come true. Or a honeymoon. Being able to see those people say, hey, I get to go. Yeah. So.
Do they come and share that with you? The good and the bad?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I honestly get postcards from clients when they're on their vacation. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And, you know, in the bad, I get a phone call. So, that's kind of funny.
Mary, what do you have as an answer for the best part and worst part of the job?
It's the same. It always is. Is sad that someone on the other end has fallen through. You know, we have no control, you know, over that situation. Or we never have been good weather forecasters. So, yeah.
But it's the helping someone out.
It is. Yeah. You know, and it's just like last weekend, I had a guy come up to me and he says, you know, I've been married for 30 years and you started our life off perfectly. And they did a trip to Hawaii. You know, so you get those little tidbits, and it's kind of an attagirl, you know, and it does. It makes you feel good.
And honestly, since I've started here, I have one client that's repetitively, every year they go on a trip. He basically says, this is the time slot. Make the reservations. They don't know where they're going until they get to the airport. And they only know how to pack. And that's kind of what I did to my mom this last go around. But it's fun. I mean, it's fun to plan somebody's vacation and, well, you know, play with their money too. But
you also know their tastes, I assume.
They're, yes.
Whether
oh,
you're
yes.
doing adventuring or food
oh,
or,
yes.
or
yes.
shopping. Or...
Yes, I know their tastes very well. And basically they say, okay, Renee. And
that's got to be fun. Where do you send them?
This last go around was, they went to Dubai and the Maldives for 2 weeks. And, yeah, their taste is beach and food. And so And they had a phenomenal trip. They said it was the best ever. So, and yeah, then you get postcards.
I'll wrap up with asking you both about your best trip and worst trip.
Well, I don't want to mention any name. My worst trip was my daughter was 15 months old, and my mom and I and my daughter went on a Mexican cruise, and it was a ship for older people, so we were the youngest people on the ship. My daughter was the only kid on the ship. The mentality of them on the ship was they didn't want to be around kids, and so that was really hard. And then the other part was the air conditioner broke, the elevator blew, somebody had a heart attack, and so we did a lot of bobbing in the water. So yeah, I mean, the unfortunate events that you can't control. But I would have to say the perfect trip was this last one that we did. And we did a 10-day cruise out of Copenhagen and saw very many different cultures, different countries, different experiences. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime trip.
Uh-huh. And this is with you and your daughter?
My daughter and I and my mom.
And your mom?
My mom,
the three
yeah.
Generations are traveling together.
Yeah. Yeah, we have taken a trip every year somewhere. And my mom didn't know where she was going. And my daughter didn't know where she was going. My daughter didn't care as long as there was a pool. But they didn't know until it was about a week prior. But we planned it all the way back in October. And, you know, the good and the bad with it is I planned everything for them. And mom didn't know. She didn't care where she was going. She was going on a trip. The bad part is some people would get mad because he wouldn't tell them where they were going. So, but you know, good and bad.
Yeah, I might need to try one of those trips. Let me ask you about your best trip and worst trip.
Oh, geez. I've had lots of best trips. I really did. I did take, was one of the tour leaders on a group of 40 people to the British Isles. And there was a lot of World War II vets. And we went to Stonehenge, and they reenacted for me how they hid behind the stones, you know, and things like that. And so that brought it all to life for me. And they, honest to God, you couldn't outdrink them. They were so much fun. I just had a blast, you know.
About when was that?
That was in the 80s. Yeah. And most of those people are gone now, and it's kind of sad, you know, when I see their pictures in the paper, and I say, oh, it was such a good time.
Yeah.
One of my worst trips, I think, was only bad because of the people I were with. The people I was with were from the East Coast, usually Florida, and I don't think they came on the trip to have a good time. They came on the trip to complain.
In Quebec.
You know, and, you know, yeah, 5 days of that was, I couldn't wait to get home. I mean, what I saw, we were down in Acapulco, and we did Acapulco, Taxco, Cuernavaca, and Mexico City. That part was great, as long as I could get away from the other people I was with.
It's important to travel with like-minded people.
Absolutely.
Even if you're all doing your own thing.
Right.
Well, and, you know, honestly, it really comes down to people. I mean, because the mentality of people is what make the trip. I mean, even if it's a bad trip, even on my bad trip, I met a lot of great people and a lot of mentalities that there are good people in the world, all over the world, not just in one spot.
Yeah.
when I have this look of confusion on my face and which way to go, there was always somebody standing there saying, hey, do you need help? You know, even in a foreign country.
Mm-hmm. And you've taken an awful lot of time with me. I really appreciate it.
Sure, not a problem. Yeah. As long as the boss don't care.
And I'll do my part to keep the boss happy. Travel agents Renee Jensen and Mary Hoffman work at Neely's Travel in downtown Moscow. Neely's is a family business. It started 60 years ago, first as a taxi company. And it's still serving businesses and leisure travels from their offices on Main Street in Moscow, Idaho. Three generations now. I've got one more installment for today's show about traveling. Installment number 6 takes a lead from Mary and Renee. I and Yin Radio intern Aaron Finner talk to people around town about their best and worst trips.
What's the best trip you've ever had? To Priest Lake. Priest Lake, Idaho.
Tell me about it.
It's, I don't know, it's serene there.
So you just went and chilled?
I actually used to go to Priest Lake in the winter and get a cabin for the weekend. And no TV, fireplace, dinner at Hills, a trip up to Elkins, little walking in the snow, snow fight.
He's young. He's new.
Head down to the Mexican restaurant for dinner one night. Yeah.
So tell me about the worst trip you've ever had.
I don't know. I don't know if I've had a bad trip. Traveled with my daughter and my niece and my triplet nieces to Disneyland and SeaWorld. Driving from Ogden, Utah via Las Vegas.
And how old were they?
They were 4. And my daughter was 6 and my other niece was 5. And we went to Disneyland for 3 days and SeaWorld for 2, and I was exhausted for 2 months.
What was your favorite trip ever?
My favorite trip?
Yeah.
I just went to Holland. I went to Amsterdam.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How was that?
It was incredible.
Yeah. And what did you do there and what were your experiences like?
Well, what did we do? We drank a lot. Smoked a lot. This guy came up from Macedonia.
We met friends there.
Yeah, we met friends. Came up from Macedonia and...
You guys went to, like, party. The Van Gogh Museum, right?
Yeah, we did the Van Gogh Museum.
That's cool.
We... What else did we do? We went to the Anne Frank House, and, which I don't recommend doing. Yeah, it was creepy and kind of awful, but yeah. Van Gogh was cool. I mean, really, we really just kind of walked around a lot.
Cool.
And drank and got stoned.
What was your least favorite trip?
Oh, God. San Diego.
Oh, yeah.
I went to San Diego once, and I will never... No. Yeah. San Diego. I will never go back.
Okay.
It was awful.
Why was that?
You know, in general, I kind of liked the area, but there were some of the dumbest people that I've ever met that I just, like... ended up kind of being stuck with. I mean, it was totally like,
right,
because of the people that I was with, but it was awful.
You mean, which place?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hawaii.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Why?
It got, you know, it has a beach, mountain, and a lot of entertainment along the coastline, so it's a beautiful trip. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, did you go with your family or friends?
Yes, I went with my family.
Okay, and what was your least favorite trip?
Least favorite. The trip to Amish County.
Oh, yeah?
Because they were near.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, basically there's nothing there, so. we drove like a... 5 or 6 hours to get there, and then there's nothing.
Yeah.
Wallowa Lake,
Oregon.
Oh, yeah?
Why?
Because there's a ton of stuff to do. There's a lot of mountain climbing, hiking, swimming. It's really fun.
Our favorite trip, probably together, minus our honeymoon, would probably be just Glacier National Park.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's a great trip, only about 6 hours from here, so making a trip that way is beautiful. See a lot of scenery that you never get to see around here. You know, tons of wildlife, grizzly bears and stuff. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your least favorite trip, maybe?
Probably another camping trip that just went sour from the get-go. Locking keys in the car, you know, food getting eaten up and stuff. So, yeah.
I think for me, my favorite vacation was I took a bunch of friends of mine. I was living in Montana.
Yeah.
And we took a road trip down through Nevada and down to L.A. because yeah. we have family in Nevada and in L.A. And we went to Disneyland. And my friend and her two youngest kids were 12 and 16. And it was the first time they'd ever been outside of Montana other than Silverwood.
Wow.
Their first trip to Disneyland and Los Angeles and whatever. And so, and then we drove back up through the middle of California, went to the Oregon coast and through Moscow, and then went back to Montana. And that was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. How did they react to being in such a different environment?
They were freaked out. but it was fun.
Yeah.
You know, they were freaked out at first and really nervous, but it was a lot of fun.
That's great. Yeah. How about you?
I don't know, I don't really have a favorite trip. I just like to travel. Yeah. I've done a lot of traveling back and forth between here in California and here in Montana, just visiting friends and family and stuff.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Traveling with me today on this Yin Radio Show. You can catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a contribution to support Yin Radio. Today's show is produced by me, Sandy Billings, and Aaron Finner. We're ending with music by Neo Key and their song Travel. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation, on the web at vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Catch you next week.